This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm with Setzer Vima. How are you, Setzer?
Hello, I'm very well. Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm very good, mate. I'm very good. You're in, where are you? Holland at the moment, on Zoom.
Yeah, I'm based in Holland.
Yes. What we're going to talk about today is aromas and wine. Do you want to just tell us, I know you're a diploma student, but you've got a degree sensory science, a master's in sensory science. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So my bachelor was psychology, actually, and then I moved into my master's studies, which was sensory science. Sensory science is the study about flavor perception. So then you get to learn about how the senses of smell and taste work together to produce a single sensation, which is flavor, which was a two-year program. And then during the last 6 months, I did an internship in England at a producer of flavor standards. Aroxa is their brand of flavor standards. And then after the internship, I stayed with the company and worked there for a couple of years. And then after that, I decided that it was time to introduce this method in the wine industry. And then I started my own company, The Art of Tasting. I give wine tastings and I provide wine tasting kits. And via those methods, I teach people about aromatic compounds.
Is that mainly for diploma-like students? I would have thought at level three, it's a little bit less diploma, master of wines, that type of thing.
Level three students have told me they find it useful for feeling more confident in passing their tasting exam. Mm. So I guess any qualification where you are being tested on tasting will benefit from this method.
Okay, let's talk about these secondary aromas.
Great. So those are aromas that are associated with specific winemaking techniques. Mm. And we mentioned diacetyl, which is a compound that smells of butter. And it's produced by lactic acid bacteria. So during the conversion from malic acid into lactic acid. And diacetyl is one of those compounds that are a little bit less fashionable these days.
Yes.
So many winemakers will choose to prevent higher levels of diacetyl because it can take away from freshness, mm-hmm. right? It can be somewhat cloying in high levels.
Yeah.
And ways to do that is skipping malolactic fermentation altogether, but you can also go to a yeast lab and ask them for specific bacteria strains that are known to produce much lower levels of diacetyl.
Yep.
So that you can still get your malolactic conversion done. So you still convert your malic into lactic acid, but without byproducts of diacetyl.
Yeah, that's fine. I sort of tracked that one down about a year or two ago. That was a bit of a revelation. It's like, because you know some of these wines have had malolactic and you can't taste the butteriness in them.
Yeah.
But you're sitting there going, well, I know they must have. The acidity should be through the roof otherwise. But
yeah. Yeah, no, sometimes you can't get it on the smell at all.
Yeah. Whereas some people, there's a Californian wine called, what is it, butter and toast or something like that, where they've really pigged up the butteriness in the wine and the toastiness in the wine.
Maybe bread and butter. Is
that bread and butter, that's the one I'm thinking of.
Okay.
Not butter and toast.
Yeah. Yeah, true. Yeah, there will remain a market for it, but it's not so popular these days.
Yeah.
That's still current.
It'll change. Give another 10 years. It'll be fine. Everybody will be desperate for it in 10 years.
Right. So then there are oak compounds, of course. Mm-hmm. Many different ones, but the one that's specifically mentioned in the one wine production is vanillin.
Yeah.
And this is, that's a useful name because it actually smells of vanilla. It's the result of barrel aging, particularly when those barrels are a little bit more toasted.
Okay.
Because there's a reaction going on. The lignin, so that those are the structural components of the wood, get converted into vanillin during the toasting process. So a slightly higher toasting process is associated with more vanilla character, as well as using new oak that has more of that vanilla character left compared with older oak.
Okay. And what about the toasty aromas you get, like smoke or charred? Is that just literally burnt wood that you're tasting?
Pretty much, yeah. So smoke character is coming from different compounds. Most important one is guaiacol. And you can find it also in smoked whiskies and smoked teas and beers.
Yeah.
But it's a result, indeed, of the charring.
Okay. Yep, yep. What about clove? Because you see that in some barrels a lot.
Yeah. So the compound responsible is eugenol. I think this is one of those compounds that you don't necessarily have to know about for a WCT diploma, but forms in much the same way as vanillin. So it's also associated with that sort of medium plus charring.
Yep.
You know, with charring, they're the, sort of the same levels as you use in the SAT. Yes. So like medium, medium plus, high.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's fine.
Right, so then there's glycerol, which is another major component of wine, formed during fermentation, and it's also thought to contribute to body.
Yes, body textural feel, isn't it? It gives body and sometimes a little bit of sweetness as well.
Yeah, not as much as you would think it would give, actually. I've experimented a little bit with this myself. So you can simply buy some glycerol at the health store, and then I've added as much glycerol as found in Sauternes, for example, which is known to have like super high glycerol levels. And when I added that to a neutral wine compared with an untreated wine, there was pretty much no difference. So yeah, maybe it does contribute, but not as much as people would think.
But the glycerol, does it give an aroma, or is it just the body that it's...
Yeah, so if you add it to water, you do get a slightly sweet smell and a sweet taste as well, as well as some mouthfeel. So maybe it does something, but it's sort of in the background.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's never a dominant character. Right, so moving on to phenolics, if that's fine with you.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So the main types of phenolics I think you should know about are anthocyanins, which are responsible for color. Your wine?
Just thing. The big heading that all this sits under is the thing called flavonoids, isn't it? It goes flavonoids and then polyphenols and anthocyanins and all that sort of stuff sit underneath that.
Yeah, so that's a useful classification indeed. So polyphenols, they comprise anthocyanins and tannins.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the opposite of volatile phenols. I'm not sure if you need to know about volatile phenols, but I'll discuss that in a little bit. Let's go into the polyphenols first. So anthocyanins, that's color. Tannins, that is astringency and mouthfeel, and what we're quite familiar with, that sort of drying sensation in wine. And they come from the grape skins.
Mm-hmm.
Polyphenols means that you have a phenolic group, which is a chemical structure, but then sort of replicate. It's like a chain of phenolic groups. And these are really big molecules, which means that they don't evaporate. They are not volatile. They remain in a wine liquid and they contribute to palate only, right? But then there are volatile phenols as well. And those are much smaller compounds that consist of just one phenolic group. And those are the things that you can smell. They contribute to aroma. An example of that is 4-ethyl phenol, or 4-EP for short, which is produced by Brettanomyces, so our lovely wild yeast. It smells of horse blanket or blue cheese or Band-Aids, so very specific aroma characters that you associate with Brett only.
Is it leather as well? Is leather part of that chemical? Because I always, you see leather in older wines a lot, but I always put it in with it, because it has that sort of same top note you get with Band-Aids and things like that.
Leather is not very well identified at this moment in terms of aromatic compounds, but it's likely to be a combination of volatile phenols. That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
So the way you can think of this is there are acids that are not volatile, that contribute to palate only, like tartaric and malic acid. And then you have volatile acids that contribute to aroma, such as acetic acid. And it's much in the same way with phenolics, right? So you have polyphenols, which stay in the wine. They're not volatile. They contribute to the palate only. And then there are volatile phenols that do contribute to aroma. So 4-EP is one of them. Vanillin is actually also a phenolic compound, so it has a phenolic group. Benzaldehyde is another example, which smells of almonds. So there's a range of phenolic aromas that can be found in wine.
And those phenolic aromas, are they primary, secondary, or tertiary, or are they likely to... It depends on the aroma and when it came about.
I can think of examples, phenols that are primary, but also that are secondary and also that are tertiary.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I thought. Okay. Is that everything?
I think, phenolics, that was the last bit of the chapter.
Okay, so let me ask some questions about that.
Sure.
The flavors you get in wines as they age, those tertiary aromas.
Yes.
I imagine, and I'm probably got this wrong, but I imagine fruit flavors basically decomposing into other flavors. You think about a banana, you leave it on the side, it goes brown and it starts to taste or smell differently over a period of time. Same with everything else. And I always think of grapes in the wine sort of rotting and developing those sort of rotting flavors. Now, I don't know. I doubt if that's true. But why do wines develop these interesting tertiary flavors as they age?
So there's a range of roots. One of them is the degradation of carotenes, so most notably beta carotene. So this is a very slow process that happens in bottle aging, where this breaks down to form compounds that contribute to tobacco flavors, tea flavors, and other processes that are going on, degradation of certain amino acids that can also form sulfur compounds or other compounds that contribute to aging characters. I can think of other compounds such as TDM, the Riesling compound we briefly mentioned, as well as sotolon, which is a compound responsible for sort of caramel-like flavors in bottle aging. But in general, I would say the primary aromas are a bit better identified by science in terms of what the formation processes are.
Mm-hmm.
And what the responsible compounds are, more so than tertiary aromas.
Okay, so there's a little bit more work to be done on that.
Yeah.
Another 50 years, we'll have it all sorted.
Yeah.
Okay, so the aromas that you're getting in an aged wine are just other chemicals that were in the wine that have broken down or reconformed into something else, and they've become volatile.
So these could be aromatic compounds that already exist, such as fruity compounds breaking down, but also precursors that don't have an aroma that break down to form new flavors.
Mm-hmm.
There could also be some masking going on. So the tertiary flavors that mask the original primary flavors that were there.
Yeah.
There are various effects.
It's quite complicated, but at least when you're tasting one, you just need to come up with what you think it smells like, as opposed to the chemistry and all about what's going on.
Yeah.
Okay. And you were saying that you worked for a couple of these, for at least one of these flavor companies in the UK.
Yes.
What are they called again?
Aroxa is the name of the company.
Aroxa, yeah. And there's Flavor Active as well, who are a competitor.
Yeah.
And they produce powders that you can add to wines. Can you get powders for faults, for example? Could I get a powder of cork taint and then just add it to a wine?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So they produce powders. They come in a capsule and you simply add the capsule to a bottle of wine.
Mm-hmm.
And then that fault will start to display in the wine. And it's most useful to compare it with the same wine where you didn't add anything.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of classes you run, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Their products are really useful if you're looking to deliver a tasting with a large group, because they are designed to be added to a larger quantity of wine, so like a full bottle. So they're very useful for taste panels or groups of students.
Nice thing is getting reliably faulty wine is always tricky if you're trying to show faults, whereas this is a nice way of doing that.
Yeah, I agree. And you can use the same method with the positive flavors in wine.
Yes. I interviewed a perfumer a while ago, and he was talking about the holes, the big gaps that people have. And part of becoming a perfumer is to become calibrated to understand where your gaps are. Have you gone through that type of process?
Where I try to identify what I'm sensitive to and what I'm not sensitive to.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, I did. I've probably tried maybe 200 different aroma compounds, and there's three that I can't get. One of them is rotundone, actually. That's the one I mentioned earlier. So that's the pepper character. I can't get it. Diacetyl butter. I can't get it either. There's one in 10 people can't get it. And then there's one other one called citronellol. And as you have guessed, it smells of citronella. Yeah. It's not so much an important wine flavor, but it's, yeah, you can find it in other things. And yeah, I'm unable to detect it.
Okay. And yeah. How?
And it helps to be able to know what your weak spots are and what your stronger spots are in terms of sensitivity.
Yeah. Do you find that people are aware of that type of gap usually or not?
Sometimes they have an idea of what they're sensitive to and what they aren't. And then when they attend my tasting, they either confirm it or they identify a new gaps.
Mm-hmm. And how do you feel about those aroma vials like Nez de Van or Aroma Bar or those sort of things?
So I have my answer ready, right? Can I ask you can I bounce the question back to you first? Mm-hmm. What do you think of it?
Okay, so I think a flavor is a reference, but it's a reference in the ballpark. So if you, like, I've got multiple kits from all over the place, and the red cherry never smells the same on one's kit to the other. The key thing is to just accept that what you're really doing is just getting a cloud of, this is sort of like cherry over here, and this is sort of like blackcurrant over there, or blackcurrant seems to be pretty good, but some flavors tend to be a little bit confected as well. Sometimes it's hard to see through the confection and the medium that the aroma's in to actually see the aroma. But once you've identified what the aroma is in that medium, it's not so bad.
Yeah, so I've got one kit here, right? I think they're pretty useful, but they have some limitation. Let me tune into one very specific flavor, that of black pepper, that we know is the aroma compound Rotundo. What they use in Le Nez du Vin is simply, I think they just grind some black pepper into the tube. And I can smell it fine, and it smells of black pepper. But what it doesn't tell me is that I'm actually blind to Rotundo. I can't get that in wines. And no winemaker would ever grind some black pepper into their wine. So it gives you a false sense of security, if that makes sense. It tells you this is what black pepper smells like, which, by the way, is something you probably already know. And then they tell you that that's what you can expect to find in a wine, but that's not the case.
Mm.
Because what you do get in wine is Rotundo, which smells either of black pepper or patchouli oil or flowers or like nothing at all. And that's what you need to know. You need to know what Rotundo smells like, not what black pepper smells like.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's the intensity thing as well, right? So when I open that box, the whole box smells of TCA. And so that's the cork taint character, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not really representative of what the fault is going to be like in real wines. So it's much better to have a wine in front of you with a precise quantity of TCA that you would expect to find in a bottle of wine with that fault. So there's the intensity thing as well.
I actually think they're quite good personally because, I mean, before I did my diploma exam, I was hitting the old Nez de Van 54 kit, something in chronic. But what it gives you is confidence. You know, you go in and you feel that you can go, okay, that's strong. Yeah, and speed as well. You get confidence and speed, which I think are really important when you're describing it. Because as a level 3 tutor, one of the biggest problems we have is just getting people to write down enough aromas. You know, people want to only write down things they're absolutely 100% sure about. Whereas if you get it wrong, there's no cost really for getting it wrong. There's only a cost for not putting stuff down. So just getting confident, I think, is really important when it comes to aromas.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, and it's a good tool to just get faster.
Yeah, and yeah. It does speed you up. I mean, I know when I've been hitting them, I'm pretty quick with my smells. Even if they're not really what it smells like in a wine, according to you.
Yeah.
They do seem to work though. And I do think you need to have a little bit of a sort of, this is roughly like red cherry, or this is roughly like, you know, strawberry, for example, is all over the place. It's always confected and it's always horrible.
Yeah.
But if you get 3 or 4 different kits, you can pretty much zoom in on what strawberry smells like. All right then, Sita, we'll wrap it up there. Cheers very much.